The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get delicious Kroger pasta sauce or pasta for 99 cents each with your card. Then get tender, fresh Tyson boneless chicken breasts for $2.49 a pound with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
To another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest, sitting in my office, a rare treat for me, is Mark Hart. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Stuart. Nice to be here. I believe I will be the last person to sit in this office. Is this correct?
It is. And to be honest with you, since it's been redecorated, you are, for the purposes of being able to comfortably invite people into my environs, you're also the first.
I'm duly honoured. Thank you very much.
Now, we've not come here to talk about my office logistics.
I think we should.
Well, we'll do that as a postscript. We're here to talk about your A17 Walthamstow event, the Rock and Roll Book Club, and your offshoot, which is now the Music Maps podcast, which is part of the family of the Rock and Roll Book Club. And then we're going to talk about what I've been calling three films that have impacted everything in your adult life, and that you've kindly interpreted as three things we're going to talk about around film, but we'll do 5 minutes on each thing. Does that sound about right?
Happy with that.
Good man. Right then, let us start at the beginning then. You founded Rock and Roll Book Club in Walthamstow. I guess why, and what was you thinking when you first started doing it? What was the impetus for you?
I've always read a lot of music books, memoirs, biographies, genre accounts, more than anything else. I do like political diaries, a little bit of fiction, but I'm mainly non-fiction, and I read and have read a lot of music books. And in Walthamstow, I've lived here for 20 years. First 10 years I stayed in because we had kids. You know what it's like. You look after your kids. But when they became a little bit more independent, there was a local music festival, the Walthamstow Fest, it was called.
Yeah.
And it was all very good, but I wanted to contribute to that. And I suggested I did an author event at Waterstones in Walthamstow. I suggested this because a few years previously, I'd hosted a couple of author events in Manchester where I'd been at university. And they were good fun. I enjoyed it. So I just thought, oh, I can do that again. And I must admit, I can't remember who the first one was. It was either Dave Haslam from Manchester, famous DJ, writer, author Dave Haslam. Hello, Dave. Whose book about nightlife had come out. Or there's this other guy called Simon who'd written a book. He's the owner of the Brixton Academy. Great story. A thalidomide, right? Scion of the Findus Fish Finger Factory. So comes from a privileged background, private school, bunked off to go and watch punk gigs, was one day wandering through Brixton, saw what is the Brixton Academy, discovered it was for sale, bought it for £1.
No.
Fabulous book. I forgot what it's called now. Brixton Academy. Anyway, great on the name of the author. Anyway, both great storytellers, both great stories. So we did that. And I enjoyed it. It was fun. People came. I thought, well, why don't we carry on? So I think we're about 8-9 years on. Must have done about 300 of these things. Our reputation has grown.
Yeah.
So we certainly, the publishing industry or the part of it, the little alleyway that specializes in music books, generally aware of what we do, and they know that we can get an informed audience along and help them sell some books. So it's a win-win. It's great.
And I think one of the things that makes it sort of a different from your usual, if anyone's familiar with a book reading and a talk that you might get at your Waterstones, is that more often than not, you've got DJing going on. There's a full-on Q&A and then a book signing that goes around it. So you kind of, it almost feels like you sort of, you cut your cloth around the guest as much as in terms of the whole experience, not just the someone's on stage talking, sign some books and go home.
I see it as a gig.
Yeah.
With a performance, i.e. the talk, which is usually hosted by seasoned journalist.
Mm.
Again, perhaps being in London, perhaps because word rates are a lot less than they used to be, I am able, and we do get some of our leading writers, music writers, to come along and host these events. Now, I've always felt that's very important because, A, these people are the best people at asking questions.
Yes, of course.
They're good at that. And also, I think it gives the author, the artist, the degree of confidence that they're in safe hands, if you like. So I see that as a very valuable thing. But the talk is sandwiched by, DJ performances or sometimes live music that is related to the talk in question. So if you have got a poster behind us in Stu's well-appointed office of New Order, but if you have, as we've had done, some members of New Order, Peter Hook or Stephen Morris, then you're going to be playing New Order music and Joy Division music, Factory Records, as part of that. So, we create I'd like to think of it more as a gig environment.
Mm.
If you haven't been to one of these events, you'll find that you'll be very warmly welcomed. We do greet people. I'm somebody who is naturally disinclined to go somewhere on my own.
Mm.
So I try and put myself in a comfortable position. So you, without being too overbearing, if you came to us for the first time, I think you'll find a warm welcome. But you're essentially in a room with like-minded people.
Yes.
And you've got a common bond. So if we've got a New Order talk, then everyone in that room is going to share your love of New Order.
Yeah, that's something that, I've often frequented your shows on my own, and I've often come away with somebody, having talked to someone I never met before.
You can't help it, really, because, you might be standing at the bar. So we've moved out of bookshops now because we've outgrown most of the bookshops. Mm. And in Walthamstow, we host these events in Soho as well, and in venues. But there's the venue I like best that we use at the moment is the Walthamstow Trades Hall, which is a working man's club, hasn't been decorated since the 70s. But it's a fabulous space. They serve cheap drinks. It's great. And I love when people come into this, whenever we bring anyone along, I love the look on their face as they walk in and they're stepping back to the 1970s or whatever. And most are blown away. And I can remember, Andrew O'Hagan, the author of Mayfly's Caledonia Road.
Yeah, yeah.
He walks in and straight away, it's a milieu, an environment he's familiar with because it reminds him of going to his working man's club wherever he grew up with his dad. And again, it's just part of that wonderful experience. It really adds, I try and create that. That's part of what we do.
Yeah, because I've been to the Mild Mail Club in Newington Green, which is a similar kind of,
exactly,
where the minute you walk in, there's a sense it's been set dressed, but that's just how it's been and how it is on that day.
Yeah.
I've been events that I can think of that I've enjoyed that you've put on, and was like John Doran interviewing the Hanley brothers.
Yeah.
Was a great thing, because John is not just a good music journalist, he's definitely an authority on the fall.
Yeah.
And so suddenly he's getting stuff out the Hanley brothers, and then the Hanley brothers are relaxed, and that makes for that does make it feel like a gig, because you're kind of privy to something, aren't you?
I do feel blessed that someone like John, who used to live nearby, has now moved into the countryside. But John Doran's a great guy. And I just feel honoured that he'll do something with me. And I feel, I don't want to overblow this, but, part of whatever he's doing, that quietest thing. Mm. And to be able to celebrate things like the fall. What I like about John, anyone who's ever attended a Q&A will have no doubt been reminded at the beginning that one of the the key letters in Q&A is question, and that you should ask a question and not make a rambling personal statement. And I remember John often reads the riot act at the start of this. What amuses me is that John takes about 20 minutes to actually go through this bit. That's not to take away his skills as a journalist, but it's a memory that I'll take away with me.
But a more recent show that I went to was Thurston Moore talking about his memoir Sonic Life, and what was fantastic about that is you get one of his contemporaries to interview, not just a journalist. You got Gina Birch from the Raincoats, and what was amazing was as much as you've got this biography to talk about, it kind of flipped where Thurston's asking her, about moments that they'd shared, kind of thing, because it's just gig going, isn't it? If you're in the same room or the same.
So this is the thing with someone like Thurston, who must have done either a billion of these things. How boring must it be? So again, we do use journalists, and I try and make sure that it's somebody that the author or the publicity person is comfortable with. But occasionally we can switch it around.
Yeah.
And with that one, and it's a hat tip to my friend Zoe, who does publicity for Mute Records. And I was just asking around. I was asked by Thurston's publicist, who have you got in mind to do the interview? And I just took a moment, and rather than go with the usual names, it could have been John Duran, it could have been, again, the other thing important to me is to have a gender balanced panel. So I try as much as I can not to have two blokes talking to each other, because hey, it's 2024, women can do things. We're not a patriarchy. And my friend Zoe, I just said, who can we get to do this? Hoping she might give me a couple of names I hadn't thought about. And on her list was, Gina Birch. Gina had done something for me a couple of years back about punk. So I had an email address and I just put it to her. And to my delight, she said yes. And then furthermore, kind of Thurston came back and said, yeah, that's a great idea. And you're right, it gave a totally different flavour to the event. And the beginning of that, Thurston spent about 15 minutes kind of just asking her about her experiences of New York, but with a clear love and passion. So these magical things happen. It's brilliant.
Yeah, because it's that idea of point of view, isn't it? Because he'd have been going to gigs, going to shows, but as someone who's seen New York from Connecticut, wherever it was he's coming up from. But she's coming over from Britain as part of some scene that's trying to sell itself and become crack America in inverted commas. So it would have seemed a whole different, it wouldn't have seemed the same as he did. And that would come across really well. And you talk about that again, it was one of that idea of gender balance and stuff. When you got Miranda Sawyer to interview James Brown about his memoir, Animal House, looking back at Loaded and not just Loaded, but Loaded is a big part of the story. And it was really good because that ended up being quite, I guess they know each other as contemporaries, but it meant it wasn't a soft soaping interview. It was like there was quite some confrontation about, what did you start, for goodness sake, with this lad culture?
Yeah.
And that opened the conversation up somewhere. Again, I didn't think it would go.
Again, these things, with no real skill on my part. It just seems to me sometimes to be so very obvious. But with that one, I would have asked both, James, hey, how about A, how about B, how about C? And he'll give me a steer. I'm pleased you kind of enjoyed that, because I think it's how you get the best out of that talky element of it. And, that's really what people are coming for. But as we've said, it's the overall night that we're creating, the music, the comradeship, the opportunity. With someone like Thurston Moore or some artists who, are still playing large arenas. So if you go and see them live, you're going to be some distance away. You're not going to have FaceTime with them. Where at these events, when they're signing a book, everyone's got their phone out. Do you mind if I have a selfie? And we do that because these people have made a huge, impact on our lives.
Yeah.
The music that they've created, whether it's The Fall or Sonic Youth or New Order, whoever, is just, it's massive. Mm. Yeah. And we just want to say thank you for that. And this is an opportunity to do that. So it's great.
Indeed. And we're talking the day after you just hosted Kevin Sampson doing the 25th anniversary of his book Away Days. And genuinely, that's one of my heroes. Like, it's weird. He talked about books that give him permission to do the book. And I'm thinking, he gave me permission to write, as you know, seeing him in print and the things he was doing was part of what I got. So it's like this, it's great that hearing it, what got him going as well.
Because what Kevin had said, the book we talked about, Away Days, has a lot of vernacular. It's written in Scouse in a large part. And I think we didn't actually drill down into this, but I did wonder if, you know, a London-based editor may have bridled at the use of the idiom. And he credits someone like Irvin Welsh, Trainspotting, who he said has written in a Leith dialect, as pushing open a door that allowed him to go through. But yeah, this is what makes that book, Away Days, a favourite for me, and so authentic, because it's real, it feels real.
Now, you've diverted while keeping the Rock and Roll Book Club going. You've now created an offshoot to it, which is Music Maps, which is now a podcast. And it's interesting that you don't record any or all of your Q&As, do you?
We capture most of them in audio. I think we actually filmed last night, but we've never really got behind the editing that you need to do to pull together a nice video package. But everything is captured. But we've never done anything with it. And for years, people have said, oh, you know, why don't you stream things? You know, I would love to come to the event, or I live in America. Can you stream this? Now, you can, but there's a cost. And really, is it worth the problem? Yeah. What I like to say to this, and it was a phrase I picked up from Peter Hook, actually, when I think someone asked, you know, can we stream it? And he said, no, we want to protect the integrity of the event. What it really means is Peter Hook sometimes is embroiled in legal shenanigans with his partners. And at these events, he can sometimes say something off the cuff, which maybe not, he wouldn't want to be heard.
A little too candid.
So, yeah. So, we've often been asked, can we do this? And to be honest, I thought, it's material for a podcast or something. You can see, if you go into YouTube and if you put up, well, actually, Walthamstow Rock and Roll Book Club, you will find some talks, some great talks, actually. Brick Smith, I think Brett Anderson from Suede, loads of people that we did film in bookshops or whatever. We didn't edit to them. There were a standard static camera shot. So hats off if you can manage more than 10 minutes watching those.
So then with all that content, then why then do Music Maps then? Where does that idea born out of then?
Well, I'm going to give credit to my co-host on Music Maps, who's Simon Cardwell.
Okay.
As well as being one of the most annoying people I know, actually works ferociously hard at this.
Yeah.
So it's Simon who will script all these things. I'm so lazy. I have no problem talking. And I'd rather just talk off the cuff.
Yeah.
Now, that can lead sometimes to rambling things, as you are now hearing. But it keeps things fresh. And I'm just lazy. I also don't really have a lot of time to do this. But Simon does an enormous amount of work.
So for the people who're not familiar with it, what's the pitch for Music Maps? What is it as a podcast?
So Music Maps is simply, we take a place, a geographical location, as a starting point for a discussion, a talk about music.
Yeah.
So if we are talking, as we did to Thurston Moore, the place we're going to hone into is, I can't remember the name of his village town now, in Connecticut.
Yeah.
And really, it is a jumping off point, because we obviously talk about what it was like when he was growing up in this small town America. But it was, I don't think he used the word stifling, but on the horizon is the shining city of New York with all this music happening. That's where he wanted to be. Mm. So, we end up talking about that. But the shtick, and it is a shtick, really, it's just to differentiate itself, is, I say, we put a pin in the map, and over time we'll build somewhere. And we're trying to avoid the obvious, because, you know, if you can go into any bookshop, you can go to the music section, you can buy a book about musical places, and CBGBs will be in there, or the 100 Club in London, Eric's, you know, the Free Trade Hall in Manchester. They've all been done. So it's nice to go and, I don't know, wander down a back road of Leeds or Nottingham or Walthamstow, where we are, and where one of our podcasts the other day was about The occasions Joy Division actually came and played and stayed in Walthamstow. They're not in any history books, or even histories of Joy Division. So yeah, that's what we do. It's slightly different to what I had in mind. Originally, a couple of years ago, I thought, well, based on the talks we do, we could do a kind of magazine format, essentially about music book publishing. You know, what books are coming out this week, Simon? Yeah, yeah. Or, this week our guest is either a publisher or, I don't know, Lawrence from Mozart Estate, and we'd talk to them for 20 minutes. But no, we've not done that. We're doing music maps. But it's another way. The great thing about, obviously, the podcast is anyone can listen to it. I mean, if we look at our Apple listeners, I think we're number 34 in Italy, the music podcast. Now, listeners, that probably means that there's one Italian guy in Girona, who's actually an English guy who's at university in Girona, listening to our podcast. So don't get too excited. But I was actually thrilled. I think the other day we were like number 4 in the Spotify music list. Yeah. That means instead of one Italian guy, I think there's 9 British guys set, and it will be guys, honestly, somewhere around. But no, it means that if you are in Liverpool and if you follow us on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, and you share this interest, you can go and listen to it and you become part of what we're doing. And if in the future we decide that we want to go to somewhere in Manchester and do a talk with Dave Haslam in his home ground, then maybe people are likely to come because they've heard of us on the podcast. Okay. So it's really, really nice.
And I think what's interesting about that, and it stands across both your events and the podcast, is that what you're driving at in the end, and I think, thinking of what I was saying about the Thurston Moore conversation with Gina Birch, is that there is a lot of social history that isn't documented. So therefore, just airing it in a public way, someone's experience, that is still a part of popular culture. I mean, I'm not saying everybody has to be Thurston Moore to have done it. So anyone's where they saw this band or where they saw that band, or it's not always about the happening. It's about what happened to them.
Yeah.
You know, the bigger narrative, like you say, has always been well documented, but that's really only edited highlights of how something became phenomenal.
It always strikes me, there's this curiosity. Somebody's just written a book, right?
Mm.
And I've invited them along to come and talk about that book. Now, your first response is, hang on a minute, I've just written a bloody book.
Yeah,
why do you want me to come and talk about it? But they have to do it because, again, it's part of that promotional thing well. And I wouldn't overplay this. People do come to our events. They will buy books. I'm grateful to everyone who does. It's a great credit to the author. I mean, obviously, many authors, if you follow authors, you will read of many experiences where they've gone to a literary festival, they've been in a tent, they've travelled 200 miles to the edge of Cornwall to be in a tent. 3 people have turned up, one person has bought a book, and then gone out of the tent, come back, said, oh, sorry, I didn't realise it was this one, can I have my money back? Ours are a little bit better than that. I'd like to think, all our authors go away feeling slightly more enriched by being in contact with the good folk of Walthamstow and having sold a few more copies of a book that, frankly, in terms of royalties, is only going to put about £1 in their pocket. But hey, it's life.
Indeed. So how can people keep abreast of when and where Rock and Roll Book Club events are?
Best thing to do is go to Eventbrite, put in Rock and Roll Book Club and follow us. And then Eventbrite, whenever I ticket through Eventbrite, one of the many ticketing companies, we don't do dynamic pricing. I don't know when this is going to go out, but this is a hot topic at the moment, Oasis fans. I ticket through this and I'm very lazy, as I've indicated. It simply means when I put a new event on sale, the 1,700 people that currently follow us get an email from Eventbrite saying, hey, Rock and Roll Book Club put a new event on.
Okay.
But we're on Twitter and all the other places. I put one post up on TikTok and I feel a fraud because I'm a 60-year-old man and really I shouldn't be on TikTok. That's for kids, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm a bit worried about TikTok. Twitter. We've still, again, don't know when this is going to go out, but as periodically happens, if you are on Twitter or X, We're not going to call it X. It's Twitter, isn't it?
It is.
Currently, and for the last few weeks, it's been a debate because it's so horrible on there sometimes. Oh, I'm leaving. I'm leaving Twitter. I am going to Threads or Blue Sky or whatever. Yeah. I've had a look at them. And basically, it's like saying, I'm going to the shed in the bottom of my garden because there's nobody there.
Certainly Blue Sky, yeah. Certainly certainly that one. It's pleasant, but it's pleasant because it's like walking through a field. and your podcast is available on all
streaming platforms.
All the main platforms.
Yes.
Well, I'll put links in the show notes to that so people can click that easy enough.
It's much appreciated.
We're now going to move into what I call three films that have impacted everything in your adult life and what you've interpreted as something else. But I'm happy with this and we will start at the top. But before we do, for those unfamiliar with the format, we're going to get 5 minutes per heading. Some of it might be, we're going to talk about films. Don't worry about that. But at 5 minutes, we will hear this sound. That loud and clear at you?
Sorry, just putting the earwax out of my ears. Works for me.
Right, so every 5 minutes, that will go off and we will end the conversation, the subject we're covering, and move on to the next one. Okay? The first heading you've given me is, and I'll start the clock in 5 minutes, is Hammer Horror Dracula, Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing, 1958.
Yeah.
What are we evoking here in terms of fond memories?
Fear. Not fond.
Okay.
Fear.
Go on.
I don't really dig horror films, I must admit. I'm a bit squeamish. And it may stem from this, but at some point, as must have been early teenage, I can't quite work out how this came about, but I would have been watching a Dracula film and I would have found it very frightening.
Yeah.
And I do remember we lived in a flat, right? And the TV room was at one end of a corridor. My bedroom was at the end.
Yeah.
If I think about it, it was probably about 12 foot away. But,
how old are you here, by the way?
Well, I don't know. You see, it makes sense to think I was 8 or 9, but in reality, I was probably about 14 or 15. But it really, I don't know. It made it difficult for me to sleep. I was scared. And yeah. I made I can never say this word, Mephistophelian pact.
Okay.
So I was lying in bed.
You can't say Faustian, that's easy.
Faustian, there we go. Thank you very much. See, we're amongst the erudite here. So yeah, I made a pact with the devil, Crossroads, keeping it music, that if he spared me, right? If he spared me from
the clutches.
Yeah, I'm a Catholic boy. I'm not a Catholic boy, but my family is Catholic. I think I was baptized, so I mean, there must be something back there.
Yeah.
But I made a pact. I said, look, if you spare me, I'm so frightened. You know, if you can see it, you know, to keep me alive. And we lived in a house. The flat was 49 Hillside Court. And I do remember saying, if you could spare me until I'm as old as this house number, 49, which when you're 8 or 13 seems an impossibly long time away, then, you know, that's the deal. And obviously that worked because I lived through teenage years in my 20s. Yeah. As I was approaching my 49th birthday, I started to think maybe these Faustian pacts, maybe there is some payback here.
Well, he's got eternity, hasn't he? So this is just blink of an eye to the devil.
Anyway, I'm pleased to say that I have kind of gone past the 49th birthday, so my fear of Dracula isn't quite as acute. I think looking back at those films, I must have watched them since. And these are classic films, Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing. I was surprised when I looked at this that it was made in 1958. So, it was obviously being shown on TV. It's very Technicolor, those Technicolor.
But if you remember late 70s, early 80s, I remember Match of the Day would be followed by, if my babysitter allowed me to stay up, would be followed by a Hammer movie.
Mine
was sort of a monster crawling up a drain pipe.
Yeah.
Scared us, but we didn't get to watch all the film, just went to bed with the terrors of that moment.
Yeah. So it must have been something similar. But that one, as I say, maybe coloured my view of horror films. I'm not a big fan of that genre. But it certainly, had a big impact on me. And that was, what I wanted to talk about.
So in that sense then, so have you watched many horror films of late then? If as a kid you were scared, is horror film something?
No, it isn't. Violence, I must admit. Sometimes you find it compelling. I remember in Casino,
yeah.
the end I'm going to give away spoilers, but there's a terrible...
I think we can spoil in that early 90s movie.
There's a terrible end, I think. The Joe Pesci character is forced to watch his brother getting beaten to death, and then he's beaten, and he's thrown in this pit, and he's still quite alive. And I remember thinking about that for days and days and days afterwards.
Yeah.
How horrible that must be, you know? I mean... that had a very powerful impact.
Yeah.
I mean, it is not, the whole movie isn't about that. You know, the Casino is a great, great film, but that is the thing. If someone said to me, Casino, I'm going to think about that rather than the relationships that Robert De Niro has with whoever. So, yeah.
Who was you watching the film with? Do you remember?
Well, it may have been my brother or my family. So my dad, we were watching some film that was a bit spooky one time.
Yeah.
And the kitchen was off the living room, and he must have snuck in the kitchen. We were all sitting there, and we had a tin tray, not like a tea tray.
Yeah.
And he just let it drop at this moment, and we all jumped out of our skins. So, yeah, there was a little bit of tomfoolery. When we were watching
this
Dracula.
This must be a dad thing. My dad used to throw cushions at us. He'd wait for us to be completely jaw-dropped, like immersed in the movie. And then he'd throw a cushion at you.
Exactly. So yeah, we grew up in similar households, I think. Whether that was he was overcoming his own fears and punctuating that, well, it's too late to say. But we were going to be... Ooh.
Well, there we go. There's our first 5 minutes. Thank you for that. Moving swiftly along to our second choice, which you've titled, and this is a new name, this is all new words to me. And so... Evil Roy Slade, Joe Aston Gomez TV, Adam's Family. What are we talking about here?
There was a film. There is a film called Evil Roy Slade.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
It may have been a made-for-TV movie.
Got you.
Yeah. I don't know if it got a cinema release. But I remember one evening we were watching this. Again, I don't know who was in the room. My dad, certainly. Mm-hmm. Maybe my younger brother. My mum could have been there. And it was frankly the funniest thing we had ever seen. And I don't quite know what it was, but we were just laughing our heads off. We couldn't speak, barely breathe. There's a scene, I think opening scene, and just to demonstrate, Evil Roy Slade, the titular character,
is
the most evil cowboy in the West.
Right.
And that's what he does. And he is played by John Austin, who, well, people in my generation, I think best known as playing the original Gomez in the Addams Family TV series, the black and white with Yvonne DiCarlo.
Yeah.
He's in this film. And yeah, I think the opening scene, he hits a horse. He punches a horse and the horse keels over. Again, I'm young teenage and I'm finding that very funny. My dad also find it funny and we're rolled up. We can't.
Mm.
Now, this is late 70s. I think this film was made in 74. So this would have been late 70s, I think, we're watching this.
Mm.
And, you know, in those days, you watched the film and then you wouldn't see it again. you didn't have video recorder or anything.
I've never heard of it.
Switch on a few years. My dad might not have been feeling too well. 20, 30 years later, what can I get my dad for Christmas? Or what can I get my dad to cheer him up? And I remember that time we watched that film. So I sent it, I found the VHS or the DVD of Evil Roy Slade. You can get it. So I sent away for that. I'll give that to my dad. And I did. And then I think we said, should we watch that film? I have never been so bored and it's just whatever magic it had in October the 12th, 1978 had gone. It was just rubbish. It was rubbish.
Oh, how disappointing.
And I cannot... I haven't watched it again. I'm tempted following this to go and seek it out. I'm sure it's on YouTube and look at it. But it just seemed stupid and juvenile and puerile and they're just the lowest common denominator comedy. And I couldn't work out what we found so funny. And I was reminded as a kid, I used to read lots of comics, the Beano, the Dandy. And I remember being in the incredible laughter. Roger the Dodger or something, and taking it to my mom and saying, look at this, is the funniest thing you've ever seen, look at this. And she looks at it, and it's obviously not funny because it's written for a kid by a man with an arrested development. It's written to make a kid laugh, and I'm laughing. And of course, as an adult, it doesn't mean anything to you. And maybe that's the same about Evil Roy Slade.
Have you been able to You've got children, haven't you?
Yeah.
So have you been able to experience this with your kids? Like the, because when you were talking about it, I do remember that being like a, not so, I wouldn't call it a rite of passage, but certainly trying to tune yourself in with your dad's sense of humor when you're a kid.
Yeah.
So you can share, laughing with your dad watching telly, doesn't matter what it is really, is if you're close with your dad, that's a really fun thing and it's a fun memory I have. And have you managed to, have you got any memories?
I can't think. There are some. We're a loving family, and we have a laugh. But I can't think of a time. I mean, maybe afterwards. On my way home on the bus, I'll remember some episode. But of course, I think our kids have lived through this glorious age where, you know, they've grown up with Pixar and with Disney, and you know, our ability to access those films.
Yeah.
You know, they as a parent with young children, you know, the TV is the babysitter, isn't it? And we rely on it a bit too much. But they've watched every, I mean, we were looking at the other day, or our Apple account, and they've got every Disney film that ever came out, every Pixar film. And, you know, those movies are brilliant.
Mm.
And we would have watched them together, and we would have loved them. I can't remember, I mean, Toy Story, funny, amusing, not laugh out loud, more cryy.
Yeah,
I think
it's
a Toy Story 3 towards the end, you know, kind of
devastating.
Gulping them out.
Devastating, yeah.
And the only other film, I remember the first film, we talk about fear and we're talking about laughter. The kind of, we're not talking about this, but Charlotte's Web.
Yeah.
End of Charlotte's Web. God, I'm tears as a child. Are these tiny spiders coming to life and their mother dying.
Right then, that's the end of 5 minutes again. Moving swiftly along to your third choice, which is a heading that's going to give way to what a lot of us experienced in this period of time, because you were right, what you said before, if a film came around on TV, you had to wait for it to come again. And then in the late 70s, early 80s, Betamax and VHS and Video 2000, two of those didn't last very long, VHS yeah. did, came along and suddenly we had control of our entertainment. My own personal memory of that is watching Top of the Pops at a friend's house on a Friday because they recorded it from the Thursday.
Wow.
Mind-blowing.
Absolutely.
The idea you could have that. I mean, iPlayer obviously takes that to the next level, but the notion that you could watch,
yeah.
or when we first got a video, being able to watch, because we only got a 60-minute tape, but after I'd played Under 11s in the morning, my mum and dad had taped an hour of Tiz Was.
Oh, wow.
So I could watch it when I got home at lunch. So for you, what's the video shop opening up to you film-wise? Because I think there's a myth, really, that film is about cinema. Cinema's a great place to watch a film, and you know, you'd always like to be there. But when we boil it down, most films we've watched them at home more than we've watched them in the cinema. So
I'm thinking of films that we watched again and again and again.
Right.
And these were videos that we got from the video shop. And
what was your video shop, by the way? Do you remember?
Can't remember. It wasn't a Blockbuster.
No.
It was, you know, anyone who got any redundancy money
invested
it in a shop. And I wasn't going to do videos. And you mentioned the format and the format wars.
Yeah.
I bought a video. It was a Sanyo Betamax. Yeah,
they were.
£299.
A few of them fell off the back of a lorry in our estate because a few people had them.
It was Rumbelows. The reason I got Betamax is my granddad, who lived nearby, had retired and he'd bought a Toshiba Betamax video.
Okay.
And I recorded, there was this, I almost wore the tape down, New Order. We're on a Granada TV program called Celebration. I asked him if he could record it for me, and he did. And almost every day I went around to his house, can I watch the tape? And then a year later, Factory Records released the first Joy Division video, which was Here Are the Young Men, Fact 37, right? Mm. And I sent away, this is how you got things in the olden days, young people. You got The Enemy. There was an advert there. It says, send a postal order or
postal
a check,
order.
And in a month's time, we'll send you something back. Anyway, so I get this tape. I have nothing to play it on. I don't want to go to my granddad. So I bought my own video. There's Sanyo. £299. If anyone's ever watched this, the film quality isn't great. But yeah, so we went, you used to get your videos from the local video shop.
Yeah, yeah.
If you had a VHS recorder, if you went into that shop, three walls would be filled with VHS tapes. You could watch anything. Mm. Stuff that came out 6 months ago. If you had a Betamax, films were very rarely.
It was a carousel on the desk.
Carousel. Honestly, it's true. And the things we used to watch, I mean, endlessly, Apocalypse Now, The Blues Brothers.
Mm.
These are films you just watched over and over again, and you could then recite.
Yeah.
Now, I wasn't watching them with a cineast's eye. I mean, we're talking about films that, you know, Francis Ford Coppola has done with Brando in. That's great.
Yeah.
You know, John Landis. So, you know, these are stand-up films, but these are things that we watched. And this would have taken up a huge part of my life and my brother or my friends. We may have watched them as a family.
Yeah.
But yeah, we were part of that first video age. And going back to where we started with the horror, I wasn't a fan of what at the time was known as the video nasties.
Yeah.
The driller killers and cannibal apocalypse. I may have seen them. I'm sure I did. You know,
Cannibal Holocaust. I saw it at 11. Holocaust.
There we go. And that's turned you into the man you are.
Indeed.
But these things, this was revolutionary, you know, for our generation. I feel blessed. In the same way I feel our kids are very lucky watching Pixar and watching Disney, video on demand and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
I feel lucky, incredibly lucky, that in 1980, 81, 82, we were able to go and watch this stuff. And, you know, I could still, you know, that opening shot, Martin Sheen, Apocalypse Now, you know, the helicopter noise, the Doors soundtrack, you know, it goes Saigon. Shit, man. But, yeah. And yeah, incredible.
What line can you throw at me from Smokey and the Bandit?
Oh, Burt Reynolds was a constant. I mean, Smokey and the Bandit was a series of films, kind of road chases.
Yeah.
Hal Needham, I think, a stunt man. Actually, The Fall Guy came out not so long ago.
Because I would, if I was doing three films that impacted on me, Smokey and the Bandit is one of my three.
I mean, they're great comedy ensemble comedies with Jackie Gleason, American comedy of comic of some standard.
Genius.
Sheriff Roscoe P. Coltrane. Is that him?
Yeah.
Just very funny, or it was at the time. In the same way, no doubt, that Evil Roy Slade was funny. I'd probably have to watch it now.
Oh, it does. It survived.
Has it?
I was so relieved because it, a bit like what you said, the idea of watching something over and over again because there wasn't iPlayer to distract you. If you had something that wasn't on TV, the idea of watching again was actually quite novel. And I watched Smokey the Bandit a lot. And I got it on DVD about 5 or 6 years ago. And I was so relieved because I kept thinking, has it dated? Will the humour still go?
Yeah.
And it's all right, it's all right.
I mean, the other one for that, a similar thing, Clint Eastwood did that, those road
movies. Oh, Every Which Way But Loose. No, they don't.
With Clyde.
Yeah, Any Which Way You Can. And
any film that has a resort to orangutan for laughs, you know, is kind of not going to last, is it?
Sadly, no, that doesn't stand up to the...
But the other film that we would have watched endlessly, well, you never know.
No, tell us. Please tell us. The other film.
Dirty Harry.
Oh.
The first Dirty Harry film, which I think is amazing, with a great performance by Andy Robertson as the psychotic, well, what we now know is based on the Zodiac killer.
Yeah.
On a school bus. Fantastic film and, you know, a brilliant performance by Clint Eastwood. Hello, Clint.
Well, look, that brings us to the end of three films that have impacted.
That was 23 films, I think, Stuart.
Well, it's more of an architecture to talk than it is a dogma. And I'm grateful for your tales. And I will put links in the show notes to Eventbrite and to the podcast. And it just gives me to say thank you very much for coming to the BritFlix podcast.
It's been an utter joy. Thank you, Stuart. Come on,
get 15% off a set of BrakeMess Select, Select Pro, or Import Direct brake pads and two rotors now at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.